It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, UW Oshkosh is using food scraps and yard clippings to create electricity. Now they want to use it to heat a building on campus, too. We'll hear about the environmental impact of the school's biodigester program. Now, mass shootings disappeared for a while in the early days of the COVID lockdown, but they returned as schools and businesses opened back up. For schools and organizations grappling with this, some have taken the approach of increasing security measures, putting metal detectors in place, or doing active shooter drills. But what if instead of increasing security, we could prevent mass violence in the first place? Our next guest spent years reporting on an approach that's shown some success with a tool known as behavioral threat assessments. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see more focus on how to prevent mass shootings? Do you see this kind of threat assessment going on in your school, in your community, maybe in your workplace? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mark Fullman is national affairs editor for Mother Jones. His new book is called Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Before we get into threat assessment, you say right off the bat, you're not writing a book about guns and gun laws in particular. Can you talk about why you didn't focus on guns and gun laws as part of the solution here?
Sure. Well, of course, we have to acknowledge that mass shootings inherently involve guns. But I have been investigating this issue for the past decade and done a lot of reporting as well on the political debates over gun violence and gun laws, investigated those topics. But for me, this project and the pursuit of this book was about really going beyond that to see what else we could do to try to solve this problem, because those debates that we have vigorously over and over again tend to go around in circles. And you know, the battle over gun laws is an important one. It's an essential issue to dealing with gun violence, of course. But I became convinced years ago that there had to be more we could do to solve this problem. And when I started learning about the method of behavioral threat assessment as an additional solution, I found it very interesting and potentially quite compelling. And that's what set me off on the path of writing this book.
And you've spent years talking to people, the pioneers of behavioral threat assessments, people putting it into practice around the country as well. Can you give us the basics? What is a behavioral threat assessment program?
So essentially, this is a method that seeks to intervene ahead of a person who is planning an attack like this. And that's an important thing to point out at the outset here. We have a big myth about mass shootings that these are, they're treated as impulsive crimes. Mm-hmm. You always hear the question, what made the guy snap afterwards, as if this is an impulsive act. But that's not true at all. The case evidence makes clear that in every case, these are people who are developing an idea for violence, are planning it, are taking steps to prepare, and are then carrying it out. And as a part of that, they are also giving off a range of behavioral warning signs. And that is the heart of this work. It's a collaborative model that brings in law enforcement and mental health expertise primarily to evaluate a person of concern, to look at a more holistic picture of their circumstances and behaviors, and identifies patterns within that to evaluate the level of danger. Is this a person who's thinking about and planning violence, and does this person have the means to carry out that violence? And in answering those questions through the protocols of this method, then a threat assessment team is able to develop a plan to intervene and to manage the situation with the goal of trying to divert the person away from this violent thinking and this violent planning onto a better path. Because these are often people who are having a lot of problems in their lives, right? A lot of mental and behavioral health issues.
Now, when a mass shooting actually does happen, we'll see it in the news. When a behavioral threat assessment works, it's probably going to be a success we don't hear about. You highlight, though, some of those success stories, including you touch on an example in Wisconsin where these methods may have prevented a mass shooting. Can you share a little of that story with us? And I understand you can't release very particular details.
Sure. Yes, there are quite a lot of these cases around the country in recent years where threat assessment teams have successfully gotten in the way of and constructively worked with individuals to prevent them from committing violent attacks. And it's a really interesting concept in the sense that the results are sort of proving a negative, because you're talking about a successful case is the absence of a violent outcome. It's the absence of evidence. So this isn't news. This doesn't make news stories because nothing happened in that sense. So there is a case from Wisconsin that I talk about early in the book in brief. And, you know, a lot of these are sensitive. So this was one where I can't share details of where it was or who it was. But it was a high school student who had been talking about the possibility of a shooting at his high school, referring it to it kind of obliquely, but kind of fixating on that over time. And this came to attention of authorities doing this work. It turned out the student also was carrying around a notebook with a list of his enemies, what's known in this field of work as the hit list, people that he said, quote, he wanted to eliminate. This is a common signal in a lot of threat cases, and in particularly with school shootings. He had also said to a friend, as the team started to gather more information around him by talking to his peers and his teachers, a friend reported that he had talked about something big, quote unquote, about to go down later in the week at a school assembly. So through these various indications, the team became sufficiently alarmed and moved to intervene and get him help to try to steer him away from this violent thinking.
Talking to Mark Fullman about his new book, Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Mark, can you talk about what this process looks like? Let's stay in the school setting a little bit. A school where the community has been trained in these kind of things, what kind of steps do they start to take when they first get those warning signals, like the ones you were just mentioning?
Sure. So the contours of that case I was describing are common. There are many school threat cases like this that have gone on. And I write in the book at length about a program that I was able to immerse in out in Oregon, in the city of Salem. The Salem-Keizer School District there was one of the early pioneers of this model in a school setting. They built a program after Columbine in 1999. There had been another very traumatic school shooting in Oregon the prior year in Springfield. So they were very focused on this problem. And the field of threat assessment had just begun to really develop a focus on school shootings specifically. It originates with some other forms of planned violence, assassination and celebrity stalking and workplace violence. But after Columbine, there was intensive focus on schools. And so I was able to spend a lot of time with the people who built the program in Oregon and had a lot of cases over the past two decades where they've been able to intervene with students like the one I was describing from Wisconsin, who were giving off these behavioral warning signs, indications that they may be thinking about bringing a gun to school and committing a shooting. And the way that they intervene foremost is to step in with constructive measures to try to help a kid in crisis. In Salem, they call it their wraparound strategy. They extend lots of close personal support. They try to create tighter connections with trusted teachers that a student may like, give them counseling, give them independent educational support, try to work with the family, which isn't always possible. There are tough family situations in a lot of these cases, and you may have parents in denial or hostile even to the idea that this is going on with their child. But by using this kind of broad range of constructive interventions, they're able to, in many cases, successfully help steer a troubled student onto a better course.
Another element that you talk about in the book is what some of the experts call leakage, a very common, apparently, for people who commit mass shootings to have told people about it in advance. What kind of training comes as part of this threat assessment to the community, whether that's a community of students or at a workplace or maybe even an online community?
Right. So that term leakage refers to one of the sort of areas or categories of behavioral warning signs known as threatening communications, the ways that perpetrators signal their intent through, and it takes various forms, comments to peers in their talk, but also in writings in many cases, in journals, and of course, in the digital media age, online, on social media. And signals like this are not in and of themselves predictive of anything. There's no one thing that tells you someone is planning a mass shooting. But where this becomes highly relevant is when a person is raising concern in people around them, causing anxiety and fear. And the need for public awareness of that combined with these kinds of behaviors is helpful to this field because it's more likely to be reported. So we just had a pretty traumatic example of this again last fall in Michigan, mm-hmm. with the Oxford High School mass shooting. There were a number of peers of that perpetrator who were worried about things he had been posting on social media, but didn't speak out or weren't taken seriously. So I think to your question, it's about building better community awareness of what these things mean, and also having the community know that they can turn for help to a program like this.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hey, how's it going? Interesting topic. Really looking forward to reading the book. My question is, based on which study you read, somewhere between 30% and 70% of perpetrators of mass shootings have a history of domestic violence. So I'm curious what opportunities there are to sort of intervene there. And I guess for anybody who has experienced that or is experiencing that specifically, is there something that they can turn to possibly prevent a mass shooting?
Mike, thanks for the call. Mark?
It's a great question. I'm glad Mike raised that because the field has learned over time about a whole range of factors that feed into this problem. And domestic violence is one of them. It's significant. So when that comes up in a case, it's an important data point, an important signal. And it speaks to also the plans they can make to manage a case, to intervene. If there's a domestic violence issue going on, or a person has problems in that territory, that's going to inform how they're going to approach handling that person and trying to help that person. And in some cases, this does develop into more punitive response. Not every person is going to be responsive to constructive interventions, but many are. And there are many cases where it can be effective, including with that issue.
Thanks for that call, Mike. We're talking to Mark Fullman, National Affairs Editor at Mother Jones. His new book is Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about threat assessments being used to stop mass shootings, hopefully before they come to that point? What questions do you have about how they work? If you work in education or law enforcement, have you been through a training like this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with journalist Mark Fullman about his new book, Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. He looks at the growing interest in threat assessments, behavioral assessments that help prevent shootings, maybe help people reach out to the potential perpetrator and prevent it from happening in the first place. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Mark, you write about kind of a contagion or copycat effect, often going back to the Columbine shooting you mentioned earlier. You have some ideas on how we in the media can talk about these shootings. You point to an example I want to listen to. This is New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern talking after a shooting at a mosque in Christchurch there in 2019.
He will face the full force of the law in New Zealand. The families of the fallen will have justice. He sought many things from his act of terror, but one was notoriety. And that is why you will never hear me mention his name. He is a terrorist. He is a criminal. He is an extremist. But he will, when I speak, be nameless. And to others, I implore you, speak the names of those who were lost, rather than the name of the man who took them.
Mark, could you talk about the value of that approach?
Yes, that was a very compelling moment after that horrific event in New Zealand a few years ago. And it was hopeful because it showed progress in that case, in a high profile public official responding to a mass attack. The case research of this field and my own research as an investigative journalist into the problem of mass shootings has revealed an extensive trail of perpetrators who seek notoriety, who want media attention, sensational media attention. And so that presents, I think, a unique opportunity to make positive change with this problem too. The media doesn't cause anyone to commit a mass shooting. However, if people have that as a source of inspiration, it tends to exacerbate the problem in many cases, with what we also know as the so-called copycat problem that you mentioned, that primarily grew out of Columbine, but now extends to other high-profile attacks whose perpetrators that others identify with. And so I looked into this quite a lot several years ago and did some reporting on it for Mother Jones, and it's in the book as well. I arrived at an idea that I call strategic diminishment, because the flip side of this is also not tenable in my view. There's been a movement to completely black out the names and identities and images of shooters, but there's a strong public interest that the media has to serve to report on these attacks. I think the reasons why are obvious in terms of the impact, but also to combat misinformation. There are a number of examples of cases going back many years where people have been misidentified in the immediate aftermath as the perpetrator, and that has consequences. So the media has a role and a duty to report on these cases in the public interest. And what I mean by strategic diminishment is really striking the right balance to kind of shrink the frame around the perpetrator and only report what has meaning and value to understanding what happened and understanding this problem better. Beyond that, we look away. We don't focus excessively on the sensational or salacious details of the perpetrator. That used to be a much more common practice in the media. And the good news here is that this has changed a lot in recent years. I think the media understands better now that that's not good, that that can have bad effects. So we're not plastering their faces all over the front pages anymore. This is a good thing.
Let's go back to our callers now. Tim is with us in Madison. Tim, hi.
Hi. I guess basically I have a comment. You know, I've raised two kids, and they were raised around guns. And I grew up in a gun culture. I'm 55 years old. We took our guns to school for English speech and didn't have any problems. I think we have to look at what has gone on from back then to now. You have social media, which has definitely been adding to it, and also both parents working. At one point, you had a parent home all the time while one person worked. So I think we have to look at how society is today and how it was, because we didn't have these problems before.
Tim, thanks for the call. Mark, a lot of the shootings we're talking about, of course, happened before there was social media.
That's true. I think what the caller's getting at is an interesting point in the sense of how it does point to kind of broader cultural questions we have about this problem, cultural and political questions. What is it about our society that has caused this to continue and to escalate in a number of ways? And I think the speed and reach of digital media is certainly part of that equation, as we were just discussing.
Sure.
In terms of prevention work, the practical approach to this is really about evaluating the specific circumstances and behaviors in any given case. So we live in the world we live in now, and that's really what the work is all about.
Thanks for that call. Mark, you mentioned a myth earlier about the, you know, impulsive snap decision to commit this kind of violence. That's not how it works, you say. Another myth you tackle is that this is mainly or entirely somehow a mental health problem, a mental illness problem.
That's right. And those two myths are very closely entwined. The notion that mental illness is the cause of all these attacks is fundamentally wrong. And that's the way we tend to talk about it in the general public and in the media, that mental illness is what caused someone to do this. But when you study the cases, it's just simply not true. Most of these cases do not involve perpetrators who have clinically diagnosable mental illness. Now, these are people who have a lot of mental health problems and life problems, behavioral problems. They're going through tough stuff and they are dealing with it in an unhealthy way. But that's not the same thing as what we take that to mean in a lay sense. These are not people who are crazy, who are hallucinating, who are hearing voices telling them to do this. That fundamentally misunderstands these cases. Even in cases where there is significant mental illness, that's rarely a primary cause. So the question then is, what is it that is driving people to do this, and how are they acting? And by trying to blame it all on mental illness, it just sort of lets us all off the hook to make it this other, but it's counterproductive and it's wrong and it's damaging, it's stigmatizing. There are many people who do have those diseases who would never turn violent. There's lots of scientific research showing that mental illness is not predictive of violence.
In just our last couple minutes, some of the things you're saying sound really hopeful, actually. If this isn't an completely unpredictable snap decision, if this isn't the result of some unfixable mental condition in perpetrators, that means, and I think this is the main point of your book, that these things are preventable.
That's right. And for me, the process of researching and writing this book over a number of years, it really drew me to that core theme, that really this is about demystifying this problem in a number of ways. We tend to talk about these as senseless tragedies that we can't explain. But for me, this became about making sense of them. And we can do that. That's what this field does. And that's how this model approaches it. So it's not going to solve the problem in its entirety, but it is a potentially very powerful additional tool we can use to prevent these attacks from happening. And that inherently is very hopeful and very optimistic. And I saw that too in the leaders and pioneers of this field, that to dedicate themselves to this work, inherently they have to have this kind of optimistic and constructive outlook on the problem. And so it's very uplifting to see all these cases that I write about in the book where they've succeeded. Again, they're not news because nothing bad happened, but when you go behind the curtain and enter this world of work, it is very hopeful for doing more to reduce this problem in our country.
Mark, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Mark Fullman. He's National Affairs Editor for Mother Jones Magazine. He was with us today to talk about his new book. It's called Trigger Points: Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. If you have worked at an institution that has done this kind of behavioral threat assessment, still love to hear from you. You can email centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, find out why the IRS has trouble collecting taxes from the wealthiest Americans, and check out a plan from the Biden administration aimed at raising the effective tax rate for billionaires in the country. And you can share your thoughts as always. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Even in the era of music streaming, a lot of people still love older musical technology. Vinyl records never went away. They've had comebacks in recent years. CDs are still around. Some bands put out audio cassettes, but that's nothing. A librarian in New York is ready to listen to some wax cylinders. As reported by NPR, those wax cylinders were the original medium for recording and even for home recording. And the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts has a collection donated almost 90 years ago with cylinders that are probably over 100 years old. In all that time, no one has listened to them. Why? Well, these things are really fragile. Even if you have the right equipment, listening to them might destroy them. The solution? Lasers. An audio company developed a technology that uses lasers and a needle to collect a digital read of the cylinders and then play them back. It'll take a couple years. What could be on them? Could be opera or somebody's birthday party? Could be a member of the media sharing unique and quirky news stories of the day. Wax on, wax off. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, avian flu is spreading in Wisconsin and around the country. We'll learn more about efforts to track down the disease and develop a vaccine. Now think about the last time you cooked dinner. You probably chopped some vegetables, prepared some kind of protein maybe, and then when you were finished, you threw the food scraps in the trash, right? Or maybe the compost? The UW Oshkosh takes a different approach to food waste. On their campus, it's getting turned into electricity. And with a new grant from the Public Service Commission, they want to use food scraps and yard clippings to heat a building on campus too. Brad Spanbauer is the Sustainability Director at UW Oshkosh. Brad, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Give us the basics, please, on how this technology works. How are we turning food waste first into electricity and hopefully soon into heat?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the big thing I like to tell people is this facility has been operating since 2011. And essentially what we do is we load whole pieces of organic matter, food waste, yard waste, those kinds of things into some chambers that are then sealed. We pump out the oxygen and then that material is sprayed with what we call a percolate, which is essentially sort of a liquefied mixture that has microbes and sort of microorganisms in it that is going to help break down all of that food waste and yard waste. And then what is produced is biogas. And basically that biogas is partially carbon dioxide, but partially methane. And so we collect all of that biogas and funnel it into what is called a CHP, or a combined heat and power unit. It's essentially an engine. And then that engine sends electricity back out to the grid. We use some of the heat internally, but now we're hoping to make a little bit more use of the heat that we're creating.
Yeah. How much heat are you not capturing now from the system? And is it really enough to heat a whole campus building?
I don't have exactly how much we're sort of not capturing. The building does use some of the heat that it generates through these processes as part of what we, you know, kind of call parasitic load. Because the chambers do need to be heated, we want to keep that process nice and warm. So some of the heat, you know, is sort of having a beneficial use right now. Mm-hmm. We just have wanted to do this project for quite some time, and we have found that we could capture that heat and funnel it a little bit more effectively to help heat a building. So yes, there's plenty of heat that we could be using more efficiently, and we're going to start doing that later this year.
Can you tell us about the sustainability benefits here? I guess on both sides, you're generating the electricity and heat, of course, but you're also preventing all this waste from going to waste.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're capturing food waste that would otherwise just be bound for the landfill, and there it is going to do the same thing. It's going to break down. It will produce methane and other greenhouse gas emissions, right, at a landfill site. We're sort of diverting that and putting it through a process that's going to be just better, a little bit more advantageous, getting a little bit more bang for our buck. And so we're capturing all of this organic material, creating heat, electricity from it. And then what comes out at the end is essentially compost. So this finished material does have to go through a little bit more of a curing process. It spends about a year in an aerobic site. But then essentially what is done is compost. And so in that way, we're very much closing the loop on this whole process.
Now, on the supply side of things, are you using up all of the campus's food waste and lawn clippings and things like that? Are you trying to import more from the community, or do you have more than you can handle?
We get feedstocks from a lot of different sites. Certainly from campus, we get a majority of food waste, basically all of the food waste from our main campus dining facility. Our union, we get pre-consumer food waste, so anything that's right kind of prepped. We aren't collecting post-consumer there yet, but we're hoping to explore that soon. We get yard waste from the city of Oshkosh. We have some customers, so some food producers in the area, they send us their, you know, kind of stuff that doesn't end up in whatever they're able to sell. So we get food waste that way. We're always, you know, looking to kind of expand our reach and get more customers to bring their food waste to us, because it's just a better kind of end use of that material, getting some more of that embodied energy out of what is kind of otherwise would just go to the landfill.
Now, if I was a student at UW Oshkosh, Brad, and I took a biology class or maybe an ecology class, is this going to be part of my curriculum?
Absolutely. Yep. I have given lots of tours, and our staff at the biogas operations, they do tours as well. You know, we've given tours most recently to a kind of outgoing president of system, Tommy Thompson. We've had UW system folks come and visit us. We do a lot of outreach, but certainly students on campus are involved either through coursework, through getting direct internships or work opportunities at the digester or with programs associated with the digester.
Now you've got the electricity, you're going to do more with the heat later this year. Do you have more thoughts on maybe expanding the biodigester program in the future?
Yeah, I mean, we, you know, I think at some point we have talked about ways to tighten up the schedule a little bit because the chambers run on a 28-day cycle. And so there's four chambers, so we can essentially open up one a week and kind of trade out, close it up, and then, you know, start it over that bay or that chamber is going to run for another 28 days. So if we can tighten that up a little bit, we could start processing more material, increase a little bit more production. I'd love to see us kind of revisit a little bit more of a composting program. And we've also looked at ways to take what we produce through the CHP and run it through a biogas boiler and essentially create renewable natural gas to fuel vehicles, right? So vehicles that use RNG or CNG could essentially get fueled up at this site.
Wow. Brad, thanks for sharing this with us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.
That's Brad Spanbauer, Sustainability Director at UW Oshkosh, with us today to talk about the university's plan to reduce its reliance on fossil fuels by using food and yard waste to produce electricity, which they're already doing, and to heat a building on campus. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about identity in the real and digital worlds.
Anyone who uses social media presents a somewhat edited version of themselves. They're selective about what they post, they use photo filters, or they create cartoon-like stylized avatars as their profile image. WPR's Emily Ralph, a trans woman, used her Bitmoji avatar in her coming out process, slowly making changes in the digital realm before they became Emily's physical reality. Over time, Emily began to wonder what the experience was like for her Bitmoji on the other side of the digital divide. This story comes from the perspective of that Bitmoji.
I was born or created or whatever, maybe 6 of your years ago, but time here is different and too hard to explain. As I understand it, my world is part of what you call the internet. It's often loud and chaotic.
Killing it!
Celebrating Wednesday here is like your 4th of July or something.
Hey, it's hump day.
Yeah!
Our understanding is that we're a kind of reflection of you, and I know that because when you look at me, I see you too. Though separate beings, we are connected by creation. Not only are our images bonded together, but also emotion, thoughts, and our sense of self. That's how I first knew. I was created as male, but that was wrong. Here, I'm alone, but mostly because you haven't used the connect with friends feature. I'm not lonely, though. I have TV and newspapers, and there's an excellent public radio station.
Next, it's the cultural significance of Wednesday, but first, it's your birthday. Yay!
Mostly, though, I watch you. In my early days, as you made changes to my hair or clothes, I felt this overwhelming sadness pouring from you, like from an old, cracked, and moss-covered dam about to give way. I knew because you did that you were not made the right way, and that pain was bigger than the sky. Then one night while I was sleeping, you made a change to my physical appearance settings, and I was suddenly whole. Suddenly fully formed, and it was wonderful beyond words. Around this time, you began using me as your representative image in all kinds of places. I was in Twitter, which I'm guessing is why you have me standing next to a dumpster fire. I appeared in Facebook, in some kind of step tracking app. Then slowly, you brought me to where you work, through Zoom, Google Meet, and Slack. You made me your face in your world, and I began to understand why. I knew that for you, the thing that was wrong was orders of magnitude more complicated than changing a setting, but that me being there first would make it easier. Over time, you made my hair longer and added cute earrings and makeup, and I saw you were changing too. first it was a smile, then your clothes, then something with your face and lasers, which sounds scary, like we use lasers in our extravagant It's Wednesday celebrations. It made you smile even more, so it must be worth it. From my place as the image in your health app, I see appointments with specialty doctors who help change your physical form to align with gender settings. As we draw closer together, I feel you will soon overtake me, that my assignment of being there first will come to an end, and soon it will be your pretty face on Slack, Zoom, Facebook, and Twitter. I am excited for you and proud of you, and I will always be here for you. But now, it's your time.
That was producer Emily Ralph's Bitmoji. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we check in on the spread of avian flu in Wisconsin and talk to veterinary experts working to stop it. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. A new strain of avian flu is spreading in Wisconsin, with two outbreaks reported in Jefferson and Rock counties. Around the country, millions of chickens have been euthanized to try and prevent further spread, but the State Department of Natural Resources has found the disease in wild birds across the state. The CDC says this new strain doesn't pose a public health risk to humans, but it could affect the poultry industry if more farms have outbreaks. Our guests today are working to track the spread of the bird flu and develop a vaccine. Adele Talat is professor of microbiology in the Department of Pathobiological Sciences at UW-Madison. Adele, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, hello.
And Keith Polson is director of the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory and a clinical assistant professor in the Medical Sciences Department at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Keith, thanks for being with us today.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Keith, your team is monitoring this new strain of avian flu, how it's spreading. How widespread is it right now? What's your level of concern?
Well, the concern nationwide has been watching it come and spread through the migratory bird pathways. It's a little bit different than what it was in 2015, where we saw it come west to east, and now we're really seeing it go east to west, totally opposite. So in Wisconsin, we've only seen a few positive premises, but right now I think the hotspots are in Minnesota and South Dakota. But we're watching it very closely, so I don't think we're out of the woods yet.
Adele, how easily does this strain of the avian flu spread from bird to bird?
Very easily. When I was in vet school, they told me that avian flu, when it comes to a flock, it just spreads very quickly like air and can cause mortalities within hours of getting infected. So it's very easily spread through aerosol, but also can be spread through contaminated equipment or personnel moving from one infected place to another. All of these modes of transmission, very easy to be done with avian influenza.
And Keith, is there much we can do to contain the spread now that's been detected in wild birds?
Sure. So containing the wild birds are extremely difficult, right? Mm-hmm. Their wild populations are, especially when they have really long migratory patterns, they go from one hemisphere to the other. But there's a pretty extensive infrastructure between the State Department of Ag and the U.S. Department of Ag to be able to identify flocks extremely fast with the National Animal Health Laboratory Network, so the NALM networks, to be able to identify them quickly, to be able to stop that spread by depopulating, to stop spread on the premises or from going from different premises that are owned by the same company or the same farmer.
Adele, I understand you're working on a potential vaccine for this avian flu. Can you tell us what that kind of research is like, how long it takes to turn it around?
Usually making a vaccine and getting it from the idea to being approved with a proof of concept and going through the licensing from the USDA, it takes about between 3 and 5 years for the USDA for animal vaccines. So we are in the concept stage where we showed that we have some vaccine candidates that can be very protective against avian influenza. But the question is, can this vaccine be used or not? Because right now, the main control ways for eliminating avian flu is basically getting rid of the infected birds. And once this done, definitely cause a lot of economic losses. So there's another potential way, which is using the vaccine, and that's what we are advocating for, and this is what we are working on.
And Adele, we see different strains come along from time to time. If we come up with a vaccine, I have nothing to do with it. If you come up with a vaccine for this strain of avian flu, is there a chance that it might provide protection from a strain that comes along in 3 or 4 years?
There is very strong chances that the vaccines that we are working on and others too, they have multivalent vaccine where the vaccine can protect against multiple isolates of or multiple strains of multiple genotypes of the avian flu. So definitely there is a good potential to have a universal vaccine that can protect against all of the high pathogenicity avian influenza and also low pathogenicity avian influenza.
We're talking about this new strain of avian flu creating a lot of concern around the country and concern here in Wisconsin. Adele Talat is with us from the Department of Pathobiological Sciences at UW-Madison. Keith Polson from the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory. Keith, I know, I'm sure poultry business owners are watching this very carefully. I know zoos, I was just at a zoo the other day, all the birds are inside, they're not being exposed. For backyard chicken owners and people like that who might be listening, do you have precautions you might suggest to them?
Sure. So backyard chickens are, it depends on where you are. So in Madison, a backyard flock is going to be a maximum of 4, right? But a small flock, let's say you live in Janesville or Plymouth, you know, could be up to 1,000 birds. So those are what we consider small flocks. So, but our backyard flocks, especially for our urban chicken owners, the best thing that we can do is watch those chickens and keep them in their coops as much as possible. Now, that can be challenging. I think probably the listeners out there that have chickens in their backyard are thinking there's no way that I can keep those chickens locked up or inside all the time. So we just have to be cognizant that there are migrating birds that are going to be moving through. That migration pattern has a finite or an end date to it. And then as the weather gets warm, I was talking to colleagues in Texas today. They're hoping that there isn't going to be any more spread because it's really starting to get hot down there. So flu should be done. But really just keeping a close eye on your birds and contacting the DACAP or the Department of Animal Health, Trade and Consumer Protection if and when you have questions. Now for the zoo, I mean, I get that question a lot too of, you know, why are these birds, why were they bringing them inside? And we all know if you've been to the Vilas Zoo, and many of our other zoos around the state, there's a significant number of zoos is that those birds are, they commingle with migrating ducks, either on Lake Winger or on the speed skating rink there. So bringing them in, even though those bird species are less susceptible to highly pathogenic avian influenza, there's a big risk to those exotic populations. So out of an abundance of caution, that's why they're bringing them indoors. And I think that's following recommendations from most animal health officials.
On a related note, Adele, we got an email question from Sue who says she needs to buy chicks this spring, wondering if it's safe or what safety measures she can take from the get-go.
Well, the good news is that we have a very good system for tracking and for eliminating avian flu in our poultry flocks here. So I can guarantee you if you're getting your chicken from regular slaughterhouses, which basically going to the supermarket, this will be very safe. And you should not be worried about this. You should be worried about some other infections like Campylobacter and so on. So you just use the general measure that you do when you're handling a chicken. Wash your hands after every time you handle a chicken or chicken meat. And also make sure that you don't spread whatever in the chicken with everything or every other place in the kitchen here. Or other food items. These are the main things that you can do at the house, but you should not be worried that you're gonna be eating a chicken that has avian flu. We have a very good system for tracking the infection and also for the inspection at slaughterhouses.
And Keith, for people who own poultry or other birds in any quantity, are there warning signs? Are there symptoms that present that suggest they should get testing going right away?
Yeah, and as Dr. Talat said, you know, this is a 100% mortality virus for chickens and other commercial poultry like turkeys. So really the biggest number one sign is that you'll see a large mortality rate in a flock. So you'll see, you know, 30 to 40, even 50% that will be dead within suddenly over a day. They also sometimes before they die, they'll have respiratory signs. So they might get what's called blue comb. So the comb on their head will turn blue because they have low oxygen because it's a respiratory disease. And then the other main clinical sign that we're hearing about would be diarrhea. So but it happens really fast. And anytime you see a high mortality event, contact your veterinarian and or the Department of Animal Health.
We'll leave it there. Keith, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Call anytime.
And Adal, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Adal Talat is a professor of microbiology at UW-Madison. Keith Polson is director of the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. They join us today to look at the spread of avian flu in Wisconsin and around the country and the ongoing efforts to track it, stop it, and hopefully come up with a vaccine at some point. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Senator Tammy Baldwin joins the show for a look at a recent government funding bill, U.S. policy in Ukraine, and more. Also, the pandemic was a tough time to learn, and reading scores in many districts took a hit. We'll find out what happened and whether we can help kids catch up. Plus, what's the biggest animal in Wisconsin today? How about the biggest mammal ever to walk the state? It's a Wisconsin investigation of our megafauna. That and more tomorrow on Central Time. Up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we take a look at major changes that President Biden is making to our immigration system. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.